Yeah, I'm ready.
Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Hello.
Just before we get started, we want to tell you that our website is fixed. It was broken for a bit. You could access it, but we couldn't, so go figure. But our most recent podcasts are now up on iTunes. If you're an iTunes person, you just have to go back a bit. We talked about Oscars and 12 Years a Slave with Josh, and then James and I talked about Nonstop and the career of Liam Neeson. And then our last episode, most recent episode, was about True Detective, the season one. But yeah, be sure to follow us on Twitter, at the MacGuffin Man, all one word, no underscores, nothing like that. And yeah, I think that's good enough for now, so let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
What are we talking about? What movie did we see?
Pardon?
What movie did we see?
We saw The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay.
Wes Anderson's latest. Mm-hmm. A director we both enjoy and covered the rest of his work on a podcast.
Yeah. We had a separate podcast on Moonrise Kingdom, which we somehow doubled into a Men in Black 3 podcast with Drunk Travis. And then a couple weeks before that, we had talked about all of his other films.
So. Yes. And so this is his 8th film?
Sure. I didn't count them, but I trust you. Okay. I trust your basic math skills.
1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1. Yeah. So, as we covered a little bit in that podcast, Wes Anderson has a very particular style and has a very recognizable style and a recurring cast of favorite actors who are back for this movie.
Yeah, exactly. I think we need to start calling them the Society of the Crossed Keys.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, I think it's better than the Wes Anderson repertory players.
Rolls off the tongue better.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this is a comedy, drama, heist, road movie?
I'm going to just say yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely all of those things.
Yes, mm-hmm. And it's kind of an alternate history, I guess, of World War II in a made-up country of Zbroka.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, all of Wes Anderson's movies take place in kind of a different version of our reality. This is kind of, but this is the one where he starts using like very obvious moments in history, you know?
Yes.
So,
but yes, it's all very specifically made up. I mean, it's, you know, as I said, it's World War II. It's early World War II. It's a fictional European country that seems to be a Poland or a Switzerland or something like that. And it's, you know, set in the outbreak of this war, which, you know, alternate history, World War II. And it focuses on our two leads, Mr. Gustav, played by Ralph Fiennes, and...
it's pronounced Rafe.
Rafe.
Don't Rafe. Disrespect the Rafe.
Rafe Fiennes. And he's the concierge of the Grand Budapest Hotel. And then we have Lobby Boy Zero. Mm-hmm. And we kind of follow their friendship and all the hijinks they get into.
Yeah, of which there are many.
Oh, the highest of jinks.
Yeah.
Do you like this movie?
Oh, quite a bit.
Yeah?
I thought it was pretty tremendous.
Even by Wes Anderson standards?
Oh, yeah, definitely. What about you?
Yeah, I was a big fan.
Yeah.
It has... I mean, it's still very quintessential Wes Anderson. Like, this is... You know, without making it sound too repetitive, it's kind of what I was expecting from this movie.
Okay.
We get his same kind of visual style, you know, it's a lot of the same actors as we discussed. Kind of a lot goofier than some of his other ones. I'd say this is more fun. There's definitely moments, especially near the end, that I thought hit home pretty well. But it's, I think, kind of a zanier one with less heart throughout the movie. You sound like you don't want to agree.
I don't think I agree. I mean, I agree that it's more consistently zany than most of his movies. I think The Life Aquatic is pretty zany from time to time, as are most of his movies, but The Life Aquatic probably the most zany. But I don't know, I feel like this is definitely the second best movie Wes Anderson's made.
After Rushmore?
Yeah. And I think there's a large gap between second and third. Like, it has, like you said, everything we expect from a Wes Anderson movie. And it's very funny, and it's got sort of that dramatic touch as well. It exists in sort of in a very exaggerated version of reality. But I feel like the few changes that are made in the movie really kind of fix the things that I feel are problematic with the rest of his films, and that kind of drive home like a thought and kind of make you want to continue thinking about the movie. And I think the framing device adds so much to the movie. And I think it's weird because I always feel like Wes Anderson gets so close to doing something great. The exception being Rushmore, which I think is great for thousands of reasons, but like pretty much every other movie he's made is very close to being great, but is missing like one little thing. And there's something about the moments of meaning in this film that kind of hit home a bit more, because I think it's pretty easy to sum up with the line towards the end where Zero describes Agatha and his child's death. You know, it's they died shortly after from the Prussian Grave disease. We treat it in a week now, you know, like it, but back then it was very, it was killed you very quickly. I think that is really is the difference between Wes Anderson, his other movies, and Wes Anderson in this movie. Like there's that line about we treat it in a week now. And just sort of the passing of time, I think is, and that type of thoughtfulness that is just not quite there in his other movies, that is here in this movie, and I think really makes the movie a much more powerful film. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the framing device, because it's, you know, we kind of have bookends of this movie. So we get the intro and we get the ending kind of two steps removed. And there's a few times throughout the movie where we jump to the timeline of old Zero and our nameless author,
yeah,
Jude Law or Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah. Yeah, we only get Tom Wilkinson at the very beginning and the very end, though.
Right.
Yeah.
But we get Jude Law throughout.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, what did you think of the framing device of, first of all, the teenage girl approaching the monument in the cemetery, kind of dressed kind of like a revolutionary, but in a seemingly very peaceful place. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, we kind of go back to her just reading the book. And it's very, and by the book, I mean the Grand Budapest Hotel book that exists within the Grand Budapest Hotel movie. Mm-hmm. We really don't get much to work with there. We get, you know, kind of her putting the key on the memorial and then her reading the book. Then we get the entire run of this movie and then her continuing to read the book.
Yeah.
So first, I want to know your thoughts on that one, and then we'll talk more about Tom Wilkinson and the author kind of in the present moment.
Yeah, okay. So I think the girl is kind of the only time in this movie that we're seeing sort of even in this you know, Wes Anderson type world, I feel like that's sort of the only time we're supposed to be seeing an actual reality, you know? And from that point, we see her reading, and then we go into the Tom Wilkinson thing, which is in the same aspect ratio as the girl sitting on the bench, but the only time the screen is fully filled with imagery is when that girl is sitting on the bench. And Tom Wilkinson segment is in the same aspect ratio, but slightly smaller. Like there's still some negative space around it. And I think that's sort of meant to represent that there is sort of this space that she can't fill in. She doesn't know all the details. She's making up as much as she can, but she can't know everything. And that's why when she's sitting on the bench, we're seeing like reality. And then the further we get into into the past, the more is fabricated and the more is being filled in by her head. You know, she's filling in what this writer's mindset was and then what set up this this writer writing this book and then the story that was told to this writer. You know what I mean? And sorry.
Yeah, no, I like the idea of her kind of existing in the real world and not even the real world of a Wes Anderson universe. And then she's reading another book. Like, it seems very much so, as you said, that she's very much our proxy. Like, her in that world reading that book is something you could go conceivably do. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's seems very conscious that she's reading a book that is the same title as this movie. It seems like only after we kind of get through her part in the real world and then see Tom Wilkinson and then see the rest of the stuff play out, that's where the Wes Anderson really starts. Like, it seems like this is the real world, this is reality. Now come let Wes Anderson take you on this whimsical journey.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I love the first Tom Wilkinson scene. I think
everybody loves it. Like the it's just so the take that starts on him, and then we kind of see it, like we hear the sound of the kid coming in, but we don't see the kid. And then we see Tom Wilkinson break from the camera and be like, no, don't get shot. And then the camera turns back and starts tracking back in after it already tracked out. I think that's such a great shot. And yeah, the kid apologizing by the end of the take, too.
Yeah, it just, even in that shot, as we said, kind of describing in the real world, it doesn't look the most Wes Anderson, but it still has that feel. Like, we still get the these dolly shots, still a lot of straight lines, everything kind of symmetrical, and you know, not much going on in the background. We just kind of have our one character framed in the center of the screen. Mm-hmm. And you know, the very kind of meticulous, picturesque cinematography that Wes is known for. Mm-hmm. And so when we get that shot of Tom Wilkinson, and again, you know, he's centered perfectly, we get another kind of slow moving camera shot.
Well, and the way the light turns on for him too, it really sort of gives you a clue that this guy is going to be your narrator. And then having the narrative voice broken like that so quickly is really funny.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you get set up that this is going to be a very, you know, we've already got the Wes Anderson vibe, but even within that context, we have a very official, like, our narrators are very often kind of omnipotent and omnipresent and, yeah, you know, kind of above the reach of the story, even if at one point they're involved in it. To see that kind of thing break so quickly and in such a kind of jarring juvenile fashion, good laugh.
Yeah, and I mean, if we look back at the other ways that Wes Anderson has used a narrator, just off the top of my head, I'm thinking Alec Baldwin in Royal Tenenbaums. He's just a narrator. And if you think about Bob Balaban in Moonrise Kingdom, he's a narrator. He's an on-screen narrator. And then eventually he becomes a part of the story. And that's sort of where he starts playing with the idea of the narrator from what I can recall. And and then Tom Wilkinson is kind of a different version of that, you know, and
yeah,
equally fun, you know, if not more so.
Yeah. And getting more and more involved in the story. Okay, and so then Jude Law, or little Tom Wilkinson, or young author,
yeah,
and old Zero. Mm-hmm. What do you think of their scenes kind of before the story really gets underway and we're just at the kind of more modern, more decrepit Budapest Hotel?
I enjoyed them. I mean, it's... I suppose I don't have that much to say about them other than the design of the hotel and how it's just sort of become a rundown version of itself. I mean, it's just kind of, it looks like it's aging, and the carpets are different and all that. And nobody talks to each other anymore. It's just the way the hotel changes, I find, is more interesting than most of what happens between Jude Law and F. Murray Abraham.
Right.
Yeah.
But
they're they're good scenes. I enjoy them, you know.
Yeah.
And and they also really let you see Gustav's influence on Zero, which I think is interesting. Like when he's ordering for the both of them and stuff like that. I mean, he's ordering just like a Wes Anderson character does, but Mr. Gustav H. is very representative of that type of character.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, let's talk about the hotel, since it is very much so about this hotel.
Mm-hmm.
interesting look to it. we get our shot, all the shots from outside the tower, the hotel are a 9-foot miniature.
Yeah.
You know, hand painted with painted backgrounds and stuff. Yeah. So we get that kind of very elegant, but still kind of do it yourself, homemade look that I think we see through a lot of Wes Anderson stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Did you think we were going to get more of a tour of the Grand Budapest, something a little similar to Life Aquatic? Obviously not the same because he's kind of done that. Mm-hmm. But did you think we'd see more?
Well, I mean, he's not – Wes Anderson likes to do things again and do them better, basically. I don't know that he could do something like the side of the ship better in the Life Aquatic, you know? That tour is just so incredible. And also, I don't think he's ever had that much money again. To build an entire ship, but no, I suppose I wasn't surprised because I don't think the geography of the hotel was that important. I think it's just there's kind of not that many rooms in the hotel that are super important to the plot, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think although I guess it was the same for the Life Aquatic, but maybe that's also one of my problems with the Life Aquatic. Yeah, no, I wasn't surprised. We never got a tour.
Okay.
We get
I think just one kind of dolly shot that brings us through a wall in the hotel. Like we get kind of the gym area into the baths where the two of them meet. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of anything else where it's anything in between that kind of outside model shot and then basic kind of just, you know, shots within the room.
I think we might get a shot from a hallway into a room that Gustav's setting up very early in the film. I might be wrong about that, though.
Yeah, I could only really think of the one. I was kind of keeping an eye out for it. And because I love that part of Life Aquatic so much, I didn't know if, you know, he would do that. And as you said, kind of try to improve on it as he tends to do with some of these reoccurring visual things. But
yeah, well, I mean, I think he did do that again in the Darjeeling Limited in sort of a more abstract way at the very end, and that's one of my favorite parts of Darjeeling. But yeah, I mean, if we sort of think of the Royal Tenenbaums exist or takes place mostly in one house, and I don't think the geography of that house was particularly set up, you know, like we can imagine things because it's smaller than the hotel, but I don't think there's like a shot going through the whole thing either. You know?
Yeah.
So, either way, he's done it both ways. This way he went one way. Yeah. This time he went one way.
Yeah. Anything else visually about this movie? We talked about kind of the three aspect ratios. There's just always so much, like, I don't know, because we did that podcast about his auteur style. I feel like we've talked about a lot of Wes Anderson style up to this point. Do you see a lot of that stuff maintaining in this one? Anything new that you liked or anything like that?
I think, well, I mean, it's weird. This is going to be the most, I don't know. This is something I would fixate on and nobody else will care about. But like that one shot, do you remember where Zero and Gustav are escaping after the will reading and Sir Jax hands them that, the boy with apple that has been wrapped and hands it through the window of the car. You remember that scene? So there's clearly a camera inside the car with Ralph Fiennes, and then it pulls out through the window of the car. I was like, wow, that's a weird shot for Wes Anderson because it's really hard to get a camera that close. So I thought maybe they were on a longer lens. I saw a picture and it seems like he shot that shot digitally. And I thought it was really weird that because it looks like there's some behind the scenes footage of it. And it looks like they shot that shot on a Red, even though pretty much the rest of this movie, miniatures excluded, is shot on film. And I just thought it was weird that he would do one shot in digital just to get that look. And that shot did kind of stick out to me because of it. But, I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. And as far as I know, new. And I thought that was cool, but, outside of the aspect ratio stuff, which I thought was good. I liked the idea, particularly since it's, you're imagining a story in that time, and the size of the frame that the girl is imagining the story in that time is kind of representative of the way media of that time looked. And
more squared than rectangle, right?
Yeah. More square in the 30s for sure. I mean, this is before widescreen even became a thing. And then the 60s, the sort of high class movies started to use that very widescreen anamorphic style that we see the Jude Law scenes in, and the 80s 1.85 kind of was the more dominant style from what I can recall. And I just thought that was kind of interesting, and I think sort of a really nice tiny note about the way media reflects in our heads, you know. Just sort of it's Baudrillard all over again, but I enjoyed it. Yeah. And okay. Outside of that, the only visual things that I thought were really cool are specific shots that are very Wes Anderson-y, but I didn't feel like I'd seen them before. Like the shot of Zero towards the end running down the stairs of the Grand Budapest Hotel, where following him from behind on a dolly, it's during the gunfight. I thought that shot was so incredible and really interesting visually, because the lobby is just so big and expansive.
Yeah.
There's a number of shots like that. And even looking up at the gunfight from the lobby with all those guns hanging over the railings, basically.
Remember that
shot? That's a cool shot.
I love that shot.
Yeah, it's awesome. There's tons of stuff throughout this movie. I mean, it's a fucking Wes Anderson movie, so I could list 100 shots that blew my mind. But
yeah, I guess that that shot, that atrium, the roof they show there, is a real atrium that's been around since the 30s in Germany, and it was one of the things that they just dressed up at the hotel as the hotel because they like the look of it so much. And you do get some shots of it throughout, and when as you said, it's very expansive. You get these big wide shots of the lobby and things like that. But that shot upward, I think, gives you a great visual of what you've been looking at from a different angle the whole time, and just. Yeah. Again, another symmetrical shot right down the middle. Just a few seconds, but I thought that shot really added a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that gunfight in general is really well shot. Sorry for the pun.
Such a silly gun. Like, just how it starts and the fact that it goes on for any amount of time.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like the Life Aquatic gunfight, which I also love, which is so silly. But, the hotel lobby was built in an abandoned department store, so... it's just kind of the hotel was very much found, and then they filled in the decorations.
Yeah. What do you think of these animated shots he keeps putting into non-animated movies? During the ski race, we get a lot of those ones from the sky odd turns by the skiers, and the distant shot of the observatory with them kind of on the end of that very long balcony walkway thing.
Yeah.
Do you think it just feeds into the kind of animated storybook thing that he goes for, and it's just kind of a storytelling thing that reminds you that it's, even when there's all these zany things going on, another reminder that it's a very fantastical story you're participating in? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is kind of one of those things that Wes Anderson does because he likes the way it looks. I don't think he sort of has a lot more meaning in them than we get out of them. You know, I don't think he feels like he gets any, that the miniatures are sort of getting to some grand theme about the minuscule aspects of life or something. You know?
Yeah. You do find them distracting?
No, not at all. It's okay. A Wes Anderson movie. It would be really hard to throw something in that's kind of distracting. I think a normal handheld shot would be more distracting than miniatures, which is the only director that is the case for.
I've used the word symmetry a lot, and everyone who ever talks about Wes Anderson's visuals talks about symmetry as well, because it's just so pervasive. And my second time watching this, I was keeping a quick eye on it, and a lot of the shots, again, you could put the mirror right down the middle and pretty much have the same image on both sides or something very close. Mm-hmm. I was watching some of the editing, though. The cutting has this symmetry to it as well. Have you noticed this?
Explain what you mean.
Okay, so the first time they, Zero and Gustav go on the train to go to the will reading, mm-hmm. and they get stopped at the border by the... swear to God, not SS division, zigzag division.
Yeah.
Which is just an adorable way to talk about Nazis.
Yeah.
As we see later again in the film, Gustav stands up for Zero, and then they kind of get pushed up to the wall. by the guards, by the soldiers. That scene, I was watching the editing, they'll show Gustav up against the wall looking over his left shoulder, and then they'll do one shot of Zero up against the wall looking over his right shoulder, and then they'll do an equal number of each ones, and the images themselves are somewhat symmetric, but if you were to compare these two images from these two different cuts side by side, that's symmetrical as well as the number of shots that they use always coming up in pairs. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just another visual form of, I guess, symmetry. There's probably a better technical editing word for it. Mm-hmm. But just another cool visual thing that adds this kind of meticulously crafted nature that is so ubiquitous in Wes Anderson's stuff, that even when you're not looking at, you know, a single image or, you know, a single shot, there's still this very particular symmetry in the way that the story is put together. And I thought that was a really interesting thing that maybe he's been doing a lot and I just haven't noticed, but it really adds to the kind of the very tidy look of his movies.
Yeah, I would suspect that's something he's always done, but no, I haven't thought about it that way.
Yeah, it's. I thought it was really noticeable in the train sequence, and then it happens more throughout the movie. Not a lot, but it just another kind of form of symmetry. I mean, everyone notices how symmetrical shots are. Even people who don't really care about visuals, it's to jump out at you so quickly,
because like 50% of the time the characters are looking at you in the shot. You know, so I mean, that's kind of how it jumps out at you. That's just such a foreign thing in most films. And I suppose the way he's always kind of cut his conversations, scenes even, has been that way. You know, we've got the Jude Law facing the camera, and we cut to Zero facing the camera, Zero facing the camera, and it's the same shot, just a different face, and you know, a different background. Like the camera sitting in between them and just rotating.
Yeah. did you like the, I'm going to take a guess that you did, the chase scene in Kunstmuseum?
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. That it was, cause this movie does get, a little dark. Like I did say, this is kind of one of the zanier ones with less heart. I do think that's true, but at the same time, it's also has some of the darkest, weirdest Wes Anderson stuff.
Yeah, it's got World War II.
Well, I know, but that's the thing about this movie is that so often these big things like World War II are ignored, and we see it very, very plainly when Zero picks up that newspaper and rushes it to Gustav, and we see the headline, you know, on the eve of war or whatever, and we think that's what the big deal is going to be, but no, it's because a former hotel guest has died. And yeah, for a movie that's not about, that's somewhat about World War II, it's really not about World War II. For something that, I mean, I didn't expect Wes Anderson to go into a lot of Nazi atrocities and things like that, but for a movie in this setting, he really shies away from World War II, but at the same time, we get some of the darkest stuff I've ever seen in his whole career.
Yeah, and well, I mean, that's kind of the point of I think the placement of World War II in this movie. First of all, I just want to go back. You mentioned the newspaper. I read this fact very recently, and I found it fascinating. Wes Anderson apparently writes all of the articles in the film's newspapers.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds 100% correct, but and we probably would have assumed it, but we have confirmation from people working on the movie. The placement of World War II, I think, is really interesting and adds a nice element to the film, because at the end we sort of get the discussion between Zero and Jude Law about how Gustav should have existed at a different time, maybe, and you know, the time that he existed in and the time that he should have existed and maybe were decades apart. And he sort of used the Grand Budapest Hotel as sort of this place where he could build his ideal time. And we can tie this into the line that we get two times in the film about, there is a glimmer of hope in this barbaric thing that used to be humanity. it's so I'm paraphrasing, but that's kind of the line that Gustav says after the first time he and Zero get stopped on the train and the glimmer of hope being Edward Norton appears and basically saves them. The second time that happens is totally different. And Gustav, even when that glimmer of hope comes and saves him, that's the only time in the movie we really see him look defeated. He starts going on about this type of prose that he does all throughout the film. And he kind of stops halfway in and is just like, oh, fuck it. And he just wants to sit and drink and look out the window.
Yeah. And it's a funny moment, but there's a lot more to it.
Exactly. It's very funny. But it's also kind of the only moment in the movie where he relinquishes control over his situation. And that makes it really interesting. And the second time that happens, Zero has to be the one saying the line because the glimmer of light doesn't come and Gustav gets killed. So I don't know. I think that's kind of interesting. And the Grand Budapest Hotel is kind of, I think it's something that is meant to, I don't think this is going to come as a surprise to anybody listening, that it's supposed to be this kind of like storybook, fairy tale, whatever you want to call it, type of world that Gustav built for himself. And it's the sort of control freak nature that the nature of being a control freak is because you think everything else around you is inherently terrible. So you try and control the things you can and make them what you want. And I think that applies very, very simply to the role of a director of a film, particularly a director like Wes Anderson, who is a well-known perfectionist. You can see it in every frame. And I think that that's kind of interesting. And, yeah, I don't know. I just find it fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Now you've brought up so many things I want to talk about.
Okay. And that's the thing. This movie gets all of that across in like 2 minutes at the end. And I think that's amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So with this idea of the passing of time and, you know, it's said very explicitly that, Gustav seems to be kind of an artifact of a different era. Mm. And as you said, he kind of makes the Grand Budapest Hotel a place for that era. And that mentality can live on for a long time. And Zero says about him that, you know, his proper time period, or however he says it, was gone before he even entered the world.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So I was kind of reminded of Midnight in Paris, which is another good movie by a prolific director set in Europe. That movie seemed to say to me, at least, that people wrongly think that the past was better or that there is a better time for them. But this movie seems to suggest the opposite, that some people really are anachronisms and some people were truly born at a different time or place than they should have been. Do you think that's what a takeaway of this movie is?
It's not something I take away from it. I think people are a product of the time that they're in. There's just always artifacts from the past around it. If you happen to be influenced by those, then that makes sense. I suppose it's a nature versus nurture argument, right?
Yeah.
But I would bet Wes Anderson disagrees with me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think that he has a lot of Gustav in him, that maybe Wes Anderson thinks he's a bit of an anachronism because of, you know, the way his movies, even the ones that aren't set in the 30s, evoke a different period in filmmaking?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think because we always get these. If there's a common theme in Wes Anderson's movies outside of like familial struggle of any sort, I think it's control and perfectionism and his characters that are always trying to run everything, I think are always sort of a placement for him, like Max Fisher, Royal Tenenbaum, Steve Zissou for sure. One of the three brothers at any given point. Fantastic Mr. Fox, and the kids in Moonrise Kingdom. I think they're all sort of struggling for control. And I think the thing that's interesting about the Grand Budapest Hotel that way is I think for the first time in his films, Wes Anderson is finally old enough to understand both the older person in the story and the younger person. Like I see kind of like equal parts of what I and my perception of Wes Anderson. I see a lot of him in Gustav, and I also kind of see a lot of him in Zero. And Gustav is the guy building the world, and Zero is the one who feels the need to tell that story, the story of that world. You know what I mean?
And appreciate it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And to discuss the importance his influences have had on him, and to make sure that that legacy doesn't go away. And we might be losing bits and pieces as time goes on, but he wants to keep them controlled. Like, you know, the lobby is going to have ugly orange carpet at some point, but he wants to make sure people remember that lobby, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, Zero at the point where he's telling the story is very clearly, dealing with his own pending mortality. And I think that's something that's really interesting about this movie. Yeah. And it also sort of feels like a father and son dynamic, a lot. And since I feel like both sides of that are accurately or, equally represented in the film, I think that's kind of a first for Wes Anderson, and I really enjoy it. And it kind of feels like a movie being made by somebody who's thinking about having kids.
Okay.
Like, it really feels that way to me. That was something like 45 minutes into the movie, as I'm just sort of trying to think, okay, what's this movie about? I'm like, oh, this is about Wes Anderson wanting to have kids. And Moonrise Kingdom was about, I mean, he didn't really disguise it, but the ending point of that movie was very much a dedication to his girlfriend. I mean, the movie was basically about like sophisticated ignorance. Like, the more you know, the less you have figured out, and the kids kind of know more than the adults in that movie. And what the kids know is that they love each other. And that's kind of the point of Moonrise Kingdom. And I think Grand Budapest Hotel is just sort of a further expansion on that, but with the kids. You know?
Yeah. Well, I got that vibe of the parenthood thing when Gustav is, I don't know, the term they use is cross-examining Agatha for the first time. And, you know, he really likes her and approves of her and, you know, kind of in a protective of Zero, mm-hmm. wanting the best for him and, you know, finding that Agatha was a good choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned it a little bit when you were talking about Gustav's quote, you see there are faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity.
There it is.
And when he's not able to finish it, or, you know, one time he says, nah, fuck it. Or when they're in the mansion and he shows Zero the boy with apple for the first time, mm-hmm. and says, you know, this thing here is the real masterpiece. Everything else is all this other shit is worthless junk or something.
Yeah.
Hilarious, like those moments where we kind of see Gustav not having that shine on him, not putting forward the facade that he works so hard to maintain.
Yeah.
Like even him eating alone in his room and things when, you know, any of those times where he doesn't look as grand and put together.
Yeah.
It reminded me of kind of this movie as a whole. Mm-hmm. Like it's, I don't know, it's elegant, but it's fun. Like, it's fun and quirky, but it's also strictly regimented. Like, as I said, there's so much zany stuff going on, yet the visually what's on screen is so meticulously put together.
Yeah, and everything is Wes Anderson lives only on the X and Y axes, and very quickly the space in between, but you know, but yeah, only to get to the other axis.
Yeah, I just, just the way that I thought Gustav really summed up this movie, a lot of Wes Anderson's work, and I'm guessing by some extension himself. I thought it was really interesting. Like, Gustav and Wes Anderson, I think, are both unique figures who kind of play by their own rules, some of those rules being really outdated, but they back it up with real heart and like a mastery of what it is they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, I don't know. I just feel like they're so good at their jobs. They're so good at their craft. You know, they've really mastered it. But at the same time, you'll see kind of these flashes of complete wackiness and complete zaniness and something completely out of left field, like the the cat being thrown out the window, which is another good, very funny moment to me. Yeah. I don't know, with this movie, I just thought there's a bit less heart in this one, but I still think overall it was a really good movie. I just thought that the way kind of Gustav and Anderson lined up, especially with the way that Anderson put this movie together, I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you saw that at all.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think so for sure. And I mean, I agree with everything you said, except for the fact that you think this is a less emotional movie than his other ones. Because I think this is his second great movie. And
yeah, but to say it's his second, or to say it's his least emotional, or one of the less emotional ones, doesn't mean it's one of the worst ones.
Yeah, that's true. But I think the reason I think it's better than his other ones is because of the way emotion, I suppose maybe it's a colder way to get emotion across, and that's why I enjoy it. But yeah, I think it's just the very small things that he added to his style, being the framing and, you know, the second half of these lines that kind of explain what was left unexplained and unclear in his other movies, that exists here, I think, is the difference between something like The Grand Budapest Hotel and The Life Aquatic, say.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I brought up the Kunstmuseum chase one time, and then we kind of got away from it. You want to go back to that? Because I'd love to know what you think.
I thought it was spectacular. Like, it's so, I mean, the cinematography in this movie is always amazing. Robert Yeoman is grand, as is Wes Anderson. But that chase uses, like, low-light cinematography so well. We get the joke of Jeff Goldblum's character picking up the dead cat from Coat Check, which is very funny. And, I mean, there's just so many gorgeous shots, particularly the one where Willem Dafoe's character enters that room with all of the suits of armor. And there's, like, a small light above every suit of armor, and then the only additional light we see is the light from behind Willem Dafoe after he opens the door, and we see a silhouette. That shot is bonkers. And, yeah, it's great. And also, I mean, he does that thing where one of the people in the chase takes off their boots to muffle the sound of their feet, and I love that always. See, yeah. Also Brick.
Yeah. Yeah, that one. I thought you liked it all. I thought you were going to like that part already, and then I saw what could be a Brick illusion. I was like, all right, case closed.
Yeah.
And so right after that, we get the fingers being severed by the door.
Yeah.
What did you think of that and the use of violence in this movie altogether? Because we get kind of a gnarly knife fight during the jailbreak. The cat out of the window is a good laugh, but there's a lot of people gasping when they actually show the dead cat on the ground.
Yeah. More people gasp when the cat dies than when a person dies. That drives me crazy. Happens every time something like that happens in a movie. Like, Jeff Goldblum gets killed 10 minutes later and nobody cares because he's a person. anyway.
Those fingers got some gasps, though.
Yeah, I suppose. But that's kind of like a more shocking thing. Like, it's I don't know, it doesn't matter. Like, the death is more important either way, and treating the death of a cat as something that's more upsetting than the death of Jeff Goldblum, I cannot stand by that statement.
Not a person, just Jeff Goldblum. Yeah,
exactly. Who's gonna be so funny on Conan now, you know?
Violence.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I guess the knife fight is a little gross, but I mean, or sorry, not gross, but bit grotesque. But they don't show much of the knife. They only show the ending. I love that whole escape sequence. I think it's great. I feel like you are on the same page with that. Them jumping over the bunks and then cutting the bars, so funny. The sound of them cutting the bars gets such a good laugh out of me.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I don't know. I guess I didn't think a lot about the placement of the violence in the movie. I didn't know it was an R-rated movie going in, but once I heard the second year use of the term fuck, I was like, oh, okay, I guess this is R-rated, anything goes. So I don't know. I guess I just don't think about violence in movies that much.
Cursing and a homophobic slur.
Yeah. I love the idea of Wes Anderson being like, I'm so well loved by progressive people that I'm going to see how far I can take that.
Well, I mean, it is a character you're supposed to dislike, but I see what you mean. Like, that word is getting harder and harder to get away with, no matter what the context is or which of your characters says it. You know, you don't have to be using it for a joke, but
yeah,
it got such a huge laugh every time I saw this movie.
Yeah.
And because everything, like so many other things about this movie, are so elegant and, you know, classy and precise, to hear the F word immediately followed by the other F word very loudly, somewhat unexpectedly. You know, it's a very kind of quiet scene. Yeah. Gustav's very, very quiet and meek, saying, "Oh, I'm afraid that's me, darling." And then Adrian Brody just yelling this slur as loud as he can.
Yeah. It's kind of like the fingers being cut off. It's something that nobody expects when going into a film, you know, at this point. Like, I mean, it used to be much less unexpected, but I'm not talking about the fingers in this instance. But yeah, it's just something you don't expect in your films anymore.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's so funny. It's effective. Like, just the, not just that, not just the words we were discussing, but just the juxtaposition of this movie, of some of the zany stuff to some of the violence, to you know, Willem Dafoe being just such a terrifying badass in this movie, for one, but when he's trying to kill Gustav by stomping the ice off the edge of the cliff, and then, you know, it's a very dark, heavy moment, and then Zero kind of pushing him over is played off as like so goofy and fun and light.
Yeah. Oh shit, you got him. Like, I think that's what Gustav says.
Yeah, exactly. It's cutting back and forth in this movie, I think, was done so well, like changing you know, not just as all those not inconsistencies, but different sides of Gustav's character that I was discussing earlier. Also the jumps between weird violence to goofy fun to zany chase scenes to, you know, humor. I mean, them getting to the observatory and fitting in with all the monks, you know, there's so many silly fun jokes there. And then there's a real kind of shocking murder. And then we get a semi-animated alpine chase scene. And then we get a Willem Dafoe's character being murdered. So just a lot of jumping back and forth in this movie. And I don't say that in a bad way. It's not that I didn't think this movie ever, you know, didn't find its step or was too choppy or anything. But I think just the way it's put together really made it everything, you know, the fun things more fun and the dark things more impactful. And I thought that was a really good feature of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just going back to the Adrian Brody scene that we were discussing, just to continue on with your point. Yeah, that line is said, and then there's like a comedic discussion of the use of that line immediately following it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
One thing I really enjoyed about the reaction to Adrian Brody's line is people that, like, at least 50% of the people that I heard laughing when I saw it, laughing at that joke, immediately are like, "Wait, was that okay?" Like, you can hear it in their laughter. I love that. I got such a big kick out of that. I don't remember if I laughed at the line. I assume I did, but I feel like I probably would have laughed either way at the reaction to the line, which is kind of an interesting thing to add to your movie. But yeah, I totally agree with the. I mean, it's these two entirely different lines that he's kind of jumping between back and forth all the time. And yeah, that's what makes Wes Anderson's movies totally different from everything else, and what makes them very exciting when they're good.
Right. What did you make of Agatha's death? And, you know, we talked a bit about that line where they describe her death.
Mm-hmm.
Her dying, you know, so quickly. And I don't know if this is fair, but her kind of overpowering Gustav in Zero's mind. Like, I was very surprised to learn about Zero keeping this hotel as a last link to Agatha, and, you know, clearly not being over Gustav, not as though he doesn't care about him or doesn't miss him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was expecting, just because we had seen so much of them together, and Wes Anderson does a lot of male-to-male friendships in his movies, and mm-hmm. it's a very central part of, you know, Rushmore, Life Aquatic.
Yeah, everything.
But even outside of, like, a family context, some real just male-to-male friendships, even though we did talk about how this is kind of a father-son thing. I was really surprised how the hotel, he says, is just for Agatha, just to link him to Agatha. He very explicitly says no to the author character saying, no, this isn't my reminder of Gustav. It's his reminder of Agatha. Did you find that odd at all?
No, because I think... I think the idea for him there is that he acts so much like Gustav. Like, again, I'm going back to the ordering of the dinner at the beginning, that I think that
he's his own link to Gustav at this point.
Yeah, kind of. And the way that he keeps retelling the story of Gustav in his own mind and then passes it on to Jude Law. I think that's kind of how he keeps Gustav alive. And it's sort of that's not to say that Agatha's influence isn't, you know, deeply ingrained in himself as well, but it's sort of this, yeah, I don't know. I think he's just sort of, he had more time with Gustav maybe, or at least more time that we see. And I don't know. It's just sort of more ingrained with him in him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it could be that, is to go back to the paternal thing. Gustav made Zero who he was, and Agatha was just someone he wanted to be with. Like, in a way, Gustav's work is done because Zero is the man that he is now, whereas he didn't really have the chance to get what he should have got out of Agatha. And that makes it sound terribly abusive or something. I don't mean it that way. But just that, you know, because she died so quickly, you know, your dad gets you so far in life and kind of turns you who you are, turns you into who you are. And then as that person, you find the people like Agatha who, you know, you can enjoy and make kind of another family with and leave your legacy with. And he never gets that chance with Agatha. And I think that's why it's important for the hotel to be more reminiscent of her than Gustav.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that tying her to the hotel in his mind, I think sort of adds another nice layer to the eventual degradation of the hotel, the idea that the hotel eventually goes away, in that,
you can keep anything physical you want to remind yourself of someone, but if it's going to fall apart and you can't keep someone alive just because of some memorabilia.
Yeah, exactly. Everything erodes, even your memories. And, and I think the hotel is representative of that. And I think tying her to the hotel, kind of adds another element to the story, because he talks about her so little in the actual story, and the focus is very much on Gustav. So she kind of fades away quicker than Gustav, because Gustav's more important to the story that he's okay with telling. You know?
Is there redemption for any of these characters, or do any of them need redeeming, or do you see an arc for these characters, or no?
Redemption.
Okay, how about just a character arc? Does anyone change?
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that's a problem.
I don't, maybe it's not necessary in everything, but that might contribute to my feeling that this is, you know, less heart. Like, I don't think there's that emotion there. And I mean, I love this movie, and I have seen it twice, and I'll see it again. And but I thought, I don't know, it's just like a Mendel's treat, we'll say. Very, very complicated and pretty, but sugary and, you know, delicious and sugary, but somewhat empty. And again, an empty or an unemotional movie isn't necessarily the worst movie, but the things that I love about Rushmore and, well, some of the things I love about Rushmore and the Royal Tenenbaums and the best moments of Wes Anderson's career aren't the prettiest, zaniest, wacky ones, but I think he does emotion really well. And I think maybe he just spends more time in it in other movies, or he does it, does a better job of it in other movies. But I think that is why that's the thing. I still do love this movie. That's why, I don't know, I just see it as different, and maybe having different priorities or failing in that small sense of filmmaking, I guess, or storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't agree.
Well, that's fine. I know you.
Because I feel that way about most of his other movies, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't feel that way about this movie. And I feel like it's kind of like it treats the emotion in the way it treats everything else, and that somehow makes it hit home better. You know, it wants to skim over it to get to the zanier stuff. It doesn't really want to deal with emotions, and that's kind of why the hotel is being built the way it is around Gustav, because he doesn't want to deal with what he can't control. You know, and that's why Zero skips over some of the moments with Agatha, and why he tears up, because these are the things that are gone and that he had no control over.
I gotcha.
Yeah. And that's what I did like. I suppose I enjoy the idea of the world around the characters changing more than you. And maybe I'm just more stubborn than you.
I need the characters to change a bit more. Who knows?
Maybe you're better at growing up.
I guess that's why I like Need for Speed better than this movie.
Yeah, that's probably it.
The character growth.
Well, I mean, there is a dramatic character change when they get to Michigan, I will. And then a change back after they leave Michigan.
Okay, that's absolutely enough of Need for Speed. We've said too much.
Thank you for listening to MacGuffin. We can assure you we will never talk about Need for Speed again on the podcast. Thank you for listening. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on iTunes, The MacGuffinmen, all one word. Follow us on Twitter, The MacGuffinmen, all one word. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.